I'm Keith Bradshaw of the New York Times and International Herald Tribune, and I'll be your host today on behalf of the FCC Board. A couple of housekeeping notes first. First of all, please all turn off your cell phones now. If everybody does it at the same time, nobody should be shy about pulling them out. You will be embarrassed if it goes off during the meal. So please, everybody check now and make sure that you don't have the sound on at the very least, and preferably turn it off. Next, I'd like to tell you about some of our upcoming events. Tomorrow, we have the Trade Minister of New Zealand, Tim Grosser. As many of you may have seen, New Zealand is the first industrialized country OECD member to sign a free trade agreement with China. And he will be speaking on how, as he puts it, how nimble New Zealand beats protectionism, of interest at a time when the Chinese are talking a lot about that issue. Next week, we have somehow ended up with speeches on all three of the days that are not public holidays. So Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, we have lunch speeches. We have not yet announced it because the flyer hasn't gone out yet, but we just this morning have confirmed Ambassador Bolton from the United States, a very famous neoconservative. He spoke here a couple of years ago and was sold out, and we'll be announcing that shortly. And that's Wednesday lunch next week. Thursday lunch next week, we have an environmentalist talking about the issues involved in expanding the panda reserve in Sichuan. They are going to resettle large numbers of indigenous people out of where they're going to put the pandas. And so this is a potential conflict between what do you do about indigenous peoples versus what do you do about the environment. Then on Friday of next week, we have Larry Lipscher, our own member here. Many of you may know him. He's going to talk about the very comprehensive overhaul that the U.S. government just put into place on how it taxes American expatriates. For those of you who are Americans and are interested in how the tax rules have been changed for you in the last 2 weeks, you might want to come Friday of next week. And then finally, coming up on the 14th of April, we have two speakers from the United States brought to us by the U.S. Consulate General, conservative and liberal, talking about demographic change and the future of American politics. On the 19th of April, we have the former head of quantitative trading in Asia for Morgan Stanley talking about the new economy of equity trading. And then finally, on the 28th of April, we have Mark O'Neill talking about the world's largest medical religious-based NGO, which is the Tzu Chi Foundation based in Taiwan, which does a lot of work. With that, I'd like to introduce our guest for today. Bill Fisher is the chief executive of EF China. They are very active in providing English language instruction, both part-time and full-time, in China and around the world. He's also somebody who's followed very closely some of the questions in China in terms of how they provide jobs for this incredible and growing number of university graduates. With that, I give you Mr. Fisher.
Thank you very much. I'm not quite as tall as Keith. Can you hear me? Hard to compete with that illustrious group of future speakers, but I shall try. I am really honored to be speaking to you here today at the esteemed, and might I add, very well named Foreign Correspondents Club. I've actually had lunch here before and been seated out there somewhere where one of you is, looking up here at the podium, and little did I know that I would someday be able to stand here pontificating for you. To be honest, I don't remember what that person said many years ago, close to a decade ago, I guess. And my fondest hope today is that you remember me somewhat better than I remember that person. And failing that, I hope that you agree the food is excellent. So as you know, I am here to talk to you today about China's obsessive love affair with English. To quote American author Raymond Carver, what do we talk about when we talk about love? I'm certainly no expert, but I assume and surely hope that everyone in this room has at one point in their lives experienced love. But for those of you who don't remember, love is a feeling of warm personal attachment or deep affection. So it's a positive thing. Now let's talk about obsession. Obsession is equally important in the context of English in China. To obsess, as we all know, about something is to think about it all the time, too much. It might border on the unhealthy, some would say on the manic. Considering the impact of sociological and economic and business trends at play on the mainland, I think it's fair to say that China's love affair with English is verging on the obsessive. And we'll talk more about that in a moment. Before I continue talking about love and obsession, two meaty topics for lunch, a bit about me. As Keith mentioned, I work for a company called EF. EF stands for Education First. Education First is the world's largest private education organization. We have around 31,000 full and part-time staff in schools and offices in 50 countries, China among them, of course. We opened China's first foreign English school in 1993 in Shanghai. Today we have around 130 English schools on the mainland and as Keith also mentioned, in programs studying abroad and online as well. So a quick disclaimer, managing expectations is very important. I'm not actually an educator. I work in education, but I am not by design an educator, nor am I a sociologist, and I'm certainly not an economist. I dropped out of the Stockholm School of Economics many years ago with great delight, and nor am I, unfortunately, a parent. But I am one thing. I do know a lot about the business of English learning, in particular in China. As CEO of EF in China, I've logged more miles than I can remember or care to recollect, and I have traveled through the country talking to students and teachers and staff about their special relationship with English, and it is a special and meaningful relationship. And so I feel capable of talking about sociological trends, parenting issues, and economic trends on this topic for that reason. The Chinese love affair with English is, as I said, a special one. It is like a teenage love affair. The Chinese love English like ardent teenagers, filled with as much angst and anxiety as passion and desire. The hopes and dreams of the educated and educating youth in China are truly written between the lines of every English textbook in the country, of every English TV show they watch, and of all of the English language movies they steal. They love English for what it represents. They love English because it is their key to a place in an emerging superpower. But at the same time, they really fear it. They fear failure should they be unable to turn that key. So it is a very conflicted love affair. One of my favorite quotes of all time comes from a focus group we did a couple years back, where we were trying to reposition our brand strategy. A brilliant young woman declared to us, "English is a pain in my heart." And I think that completely sums up how many Chinese feel about English. English was not a pain in her neck. It was not a pain anywhere else on her body. It was not a mere nuisance. It was an emotional pain. It was a pain in her heart, and she truly meant this. And for many on the mainland, I think that speaks volumes. Their love affair with English is unrequited in large. So let's take a quick look at what's going on in China now. First, I'm going to talk about private education in general, not specifically English, though the two are very much related. We believe China is fertile ground for an education revolution for a few reasons I'm about to mention. First reason is quite obvious for anyone who is Chinese or has Chinese heritage or has spent much time in the region. Education is already and has long been a high priority for Chinese people. That is borne out in statistics. The Chinese spend 13% of discretionary household income on education. That's third after housing and food. So once they put a roof over their heads and food on their plates, they turn their attention to education. They spend 13% of what they can on education. Now, to give that some relevance and compare to my poor country, America, the United States, American families spend 2% of their money on education. So a striking contrast, 13% to 2%. It's a big difference. Second reason, maybe also a little bit obvious. China is ready for change in education simply because there's a lot more money to be spent on it, and there are fewer children to spend it on. As we all know, since 1978, China has enforced a one-child policy. That year, the per capita GDP in the country nationally was a little bit under $200. Today, it's closing in on 4,000. 3,400, I think, is the number this year. And that's nationally. So imagine the rate of change in a city like Shanghai, where I live, dramatically more. And as more and more Chinese move from agriculture to rural to urban areas, and move from farming to manufacturing to service sector, that probably will continue. That wage growth will continue. So more money will be available for education. Which leads me to the next point. While there are fewer children, many more can afford to go to school. Now, one thing to keep in mind that I think many of you intuitively understand, in a one-child policy system, there are a lot of people paying for that child's education. There are a lot of people focusing on that child. Two parents and generally two sets of grandparents. And that fuels a lot of spending in our industry. 10 million high school students last year took the evil 9-hour-long university entrance exam, the Gaokao. 9-hour exam, I can't imagine how painful that must be. But only 3 of 5 of these students actually went to university. So 40% took the exam, didn't go to university. That's a huge gap. This shortcoming, of course, has fueled a large industry in test preparation, not just for English, but for all subjects. That is flourishing, where we actually do not participate because we don't believe that is the way forward for our students. But despite this this gap between applicants and spaces, there are already 19 million students enrolled in China's colleges and universities. That's a 6-fold increase in a decade. China has 1,900 institutions of higher learning, which is twice as many as in 2000. So a boom in the public education space. This stunning growth leads me to really the highlight of this section of the speech, the fact that there are simply not enough jobs for this number of qualified candidates. And that is something that many people outside of China just don't understand. But while the Chinese economy is roaring ahead, we're all in awe of this economy, and it's blowing the rest of the world away, there are just not enough white-collar jobs for people that graduate with high degrees. According to the Ministry of Labor and Social Security, in 2007, there were 24 million new job applicants. That same year, there were 12 new job openings. Huge gap, 24 million to 12. Think of the look on the faces of those 12 million people. That's what we see every day in our schools. And that gap will probably continue to widen in the future. Now, it's easy to sit here in Hong Kong in front of our nice lunch and treat these as abstract concepts. But the human gap of this, the human effect of this jobs gap is really profound. And you have to actually meet these students to see it and feel it and understand it. And that's what we do often in our programs. But getting a critical edge over others, over their peers, in competing for those precious jobs that are out there has become an overwhelming priority for Chinese youth. When we entered China, we served at our youngest age students were middle school students. This was in 1993. Today, our youngest students are 3-year-olds. And Chinese parents are not placing their children in our care as daycare, as they do in many other countries. They are placing their children in our care for a very tactical reason: performance enhancement, to get an edge up on the competition, which are the other 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds and 5-year-olds. And this does not end at any age. It transcends all ages and demographic groups. So it's this intense interest that's helping fuel the current boom in the larger private education industry. Of course, and happily, EF is one of the main recipients of this growth, but sadly far from alone. The current estimated size of the private education market in China is something around $14 billion, and we think it's growing at around 15% a year, twice the rate of GDP growth roughly in the country. So it's outpacing even a booming economy. And the reasons for that, I think, are clear. Very strong cultural emphasis on education, borne out in statistics. More families are able to afford to spend money to send their children to universities and colleges and schools, but not enough places. More money being spent to give those children a critical edge to win one of those spaces. But finally, a growing economy that does not yield enough white-collar jobs to satisfy those college graduates. So no wonder the private education industry is booming. Now let's look specifically at English, get back to the love affair. Let's talk about how English has permeated China and really led to this obsession. Probably the number one factor behind the growth and importance of English in China, and certainly the most overlooked, is the growth of the internet. Right now, 300 million Chinese citizens are one click away from the wonders and indeed the perils of the World Wide Web. Despite government censorship, there's still perils out there. At the same time, 56% of information published on the web is in English. So the majority of all material published to the World Wide Web is in English, and China is just one click away from it. Incidentally and strangely, and I'm not sure I believe this statistic, but German is the number two most published language at 7.7%, according to the study we read. In any case, China is immersed through the internet in English. At the same time, globalization, more obviously, has forced and led China to look outward in a number of ways. First one, of course, is that foreign multinationals have moved headquarters and important offices to China. In the last few years, 612 have moved to Shanghai and 164 have moved to Beijing. And in the workplace, you can see some effect here in the wages of Chinese workers. Worldwide, I think Business Week actually did a report many years ago, more than a decade ago, that said that proficiency in English yielded a 35% increase in salary against those equally talented people who didn't have proficiency in English. In China, that number is much higher. Of course, it varies by industry, but it is much higher. At the same time, tourism has changed China dramatically, both inbound and outbound tourism. Foreigners are coming in droves, as we all know. We are among them, some of us, to visit the mainland. In 2007, 55 million foreigners visited China, compared to a couple decades before, where it was about 1.4 million in 1985. Outbound tourism, of course, is also booming, maybe more profound phenomenon. The growing middle class, those people who are immersed in English through the web and through the opening of media in the country, are eager and aching to see the rest of the world. And when they travel to the rest of the world, they speak English. They don't go to France and speak French. They can't. They speak English. They try. So that has had a profound effect also. The number of mainland tourists exiting the country tripled between 1998 and 2002. I have no doubt that it tripled in the years subsequent to that. And by 2020, China should be the number one tourist country in the world, with 100 million outbound travelers. Finally, China is, and very practically, addressing the focus on globalization in their planning system through changes in education policy. The Chinese government has made schools teach English earlier, so younger children are learning English. And as I mentioned, that 9-hour-long university entrance exam has a component for English, and 25% of the score on that test is about English. So 25% of the child's future is based on how well they do on the English component of that test. So the net of this is that China has become immersed in English. 300 million people today study English in China. You got to love China for these incredible numbers. 300 million people. So more people study English in China than study English in the United States. Most of these students are, of course, studying in public schools. But there's a considerable and growing segment of Chinese people who are studying in private schools like ours. Historically, the majority of these students have purchased test preparation courses, however, and that is a business where we don't operate. And this brings me to I think, perhaps the greatest problem in our industry in China, and that is that China's obsession with test taking has actually interfered with their ability to learn English. Employers in China that we talk to, and we have a corporate training business and intimate dialogue with those customers, they communicate one very simple thing, and that is that we need employees who speak English for the real world. And that is what these many universities I mentioned before do not manufacture. So what is English for the real world? Well, English, as I think you all intuitively understand, is simply not a knowledge subject. It is a skill. Of course, knowledge is important to the skill, but it is more a skill than a knowledge subject. Learning to speak English, in my view, has more to do with the practice of yoga than it does with philosophy and history. You can't do a headstand by reading about a headstand in a book, and you cannot learn to speak English by reading about English in a book. Nor can you, by the way, learn English by sitting in a giant room like this and shouting out simple phrases at your teacher, which is what a lot of students in China are forced to do to learn. The best way to learn English is to speak it a lot, to write it a lot, and ideally with the help of a trained native-speaking English teacher. A quick aside, everyone I talk to has a funny story about crimes committed against English, and we have a whole section of our public website dedicated to this that's very lively that I can recommend. And I recall a colleague of mine who, a few years back, interviewed two very talented young people in China for a position in our office in Shanghai, and she unfortunately had to tell Fluffy and Meat, those were the names that these two students had chosen, that the most problematic part of their CV was not actually their experience, but the names that they had chosen. And these were names that had slipped past years and years and years of teachers. These were the names that, in fact, they had gotten in the classrooms of the past. That, in a roundabout way, perhaps underlines what we believe, which is that the best way to learn English is with the help of a trained, ideally native-speaking English teacher, but surely a fluent speaker of English. But the sheer volume of students in China presents a very, very, very fundamental problem, an obvious problem. When you have 300 million students of English in China, how many teachers do you need? How many teachers do you think there are in China today, native-speaking English teachers? We believe there are under 5,000 trained native-speaking English teachers in China. That's a teacher-student ratio of around 60,000 to 1. So I think that is an obvious equation. Now, to be fair, a little quick parenthetical. I don't want anyone leaving this room feeling that EF as an institution doesn't value highly the assets of non-native-speaking teachers. That is not true. We hire many, and they are fantastic. But most teachers in Chinese public schools are certainly not native speakers, and they are most definitely not fluent speakers, and they are, even worse, not trained to teach English in a classroom. And that is the core problem. Such teachers are capable only of teaching knowledge. They are great at teaching vocabulary and grammar, but they are miserable, unfortunately, at teaching the art of speaking in a real-world setting. So the conclusion is very clear. Employers want this, they can't get it, and that is fueling a huge growth in our industry. So let's talk quickly about the downside of love, something that many of us have probably suffered from, getting dumped. This is a little bit of a side note, but China's relationship issues with English have been getting a lot of media coverage in the past few years, and primarily around the photo op of the massive stadium learning system where people shout out at the teacher. But the local press has been reporting on a very different thing, and that is the bankruptcies of several prominent English school chains in China. So what's up with that? Why, if the industry is booming so much, why are companies going out of business? That's a very good question. Our industry, to be fair, has long been prone to sketchy players, new entrants, who are a little bit fly-by-night. And the simple reason for that is that there are very low barriers to entry to opening an English school in most markets. And worse, there are very few economies of scale. So there's not that much reason to get big. Getting big doesn't make you that much more profitable in the traditional learning space. And that means it's a low-margin business. On top of that, most schools, and because it's a low-margin business, they're stuck. So most schools compete in one market and in one segment. It's very, very unusual that companies are able to compete across segments, kids, adults, corporations, et cetera. And it's almost unheard of. There are only a handful of companies in the world who compete across segments, across markets. And That means that if your market segment goes sour, you die very quickly. And that's what's happened in the last couple of years. These breakups can be really ugly. In the last 12 months, three chains have gone under in China. 2 years ago, the largest English school in Japan, and one of the largest in the world, a company called Nova, went bankrupt and left 500,000 students without their classes, a few thousand teachers without without money, and some of them without food. It was actually a big social problem. And this has happened in many countries over the past few years. We're not perfect either, but we have avoided that trap. We often joke that EF could write a book called Every Mistake You Can Make Opening a Business in China. And I would be a prominent figure in that book, unfortunately. But we've made many mistakes. We've chosen the wrong partner. We pursued the wrong licensing strategy. Most egregiously, we segmented, in the 90s, we segmented the market, I think, quite improperly, and that slowed our growth down. But we didn't make that one mistake. We did not make the single segment mistake. So we have always seen our business as being across all segments and, given our legacy, across all markets. So the moral of the story, going back to the stretching the love metaphor a little bit, is play the field. Over time, the market will favor companies that are both international and diversified. And simple reason is that you can invest through a downturn. And proof of that is that last year, our company spent more on research and development than in any year in past history, despite a slowing of the economy. So, lovebirds, let's look ahead. As far as I can see, the core challenges in China are three. Students today are very tactical. They want to improve fast, get in and out. They are not lifestyle purchasers like in many other markets, Japan, for example. There are hundreds of millions of students and not enough qualified teachers to teach them. That's the second problem. And the third problem is that the real world, excuse me, speaking and writing skills that these students need once they hit the workplace are not easily taught. So is this an intractable problem? It sort of sounds like one. We don't think so. We think that there's a simple solution, and it's literally at our fingertips. Technology. Now, technology is a controversial topic in the world of education. Many educators don't like it. It's anti-humanist. But our take on technology and education is very different. It is highly humanist. Compare the classrooms of today to the classrooms of 1910, 100 years ago. How different are they? They're not that different. The blackboard's a whiteboard in most classrooms. Compare the hospital of today to the hospital of 1910. How different are they? Tremendously different. Billions of dollars are spent on medicines to help you live longer. Billions of dollars are spent on medical devices. A lot of money is spent on making doctors smarter, better, faster, making nurses give better care. This isn't being done in the world of education, and that's a huge problem that we as people need to take seriously and are not. In our industry, we believe technology is the way forward, the only way forward. And we think our industry needs to be reshaped from top to bottom. Local English teachers need to do what they do best, and that is coach, mentor, advise, to motivate students. They can do that. They do that every day all over the world. They're very good at that. Hard skills like grammar, vocabulary, memorizing things, those can and should be taught using modern interactive media, online gaming, things that dare to be fun, even though they're educational. This is something that we're underinvesting in as an industry. And most importantly, maybe, speaking practice can and should be gained online, on demand, through accessing native speaking teachers through the internet. It is being done today. Our online business, Englishtown, has teacher centers around the world where we teach students 24 hours a day, right this very moment. And it works, but it is still not being used enough. And most of all, money needs to be invested by companies like ours and all of our competitors and by governments into making education something more than mind-numbing. We need to raise the bar on how good education can be. There's a difference between World of Warcraft and most online games. There's a difference between Avatar and most three-hour movies. You might not like Avatar, but I think you understand the difference. There's a big difference between the amount of engagement created in that movie and the amount of effort spent in making that experience compelling and a normal movie. That's what we need to see in education. We've made it our mission at EF to make sure that English is not a pain in the hearts of our students. And we're really, truly super excited about the future because of what technology can offer us today. We're envisioning a post-broadband world where bandwidth is infinite, processing power is infinite. Bill Gates talked about this at a speech I saw in Stockholm 20 years ago, and it is really happening. The handset you're holding today in 3 or 4 years will have the processing power of your PC and the same bandwidth, maybe more. And that allows us as educators to really surround our students for the first time in totally accessible, highly engaging, individualized learning materials. And that is important for all education companies and the education system in general to really embrace that kind of innovation. We think that's the future. So, will we all live happily ever after? Well, I certainly can't say for sure. The nature of love is volatile. I certainly know that. China's love affair with English is destined to be, for some years to come, as I mentioned, a teenage love affair. Passionate, evolving, conflicted, sometimes sorrowful, but sometimes very inspirational. While our students sometimes hate English for being such a high-maintenance partner, they love it also for how it makes them feel, like they can become citizens of the world, like they can, for the first time, earn an international identity, something that their parents and their grandparents simply could not have. It's an important symbol for them. For every student today who sees English as a pain in her heart, there are others, fortunately many others, who know that English is a very positive thing. It's key to the new world. So if you consider English as a bridge between cultures, I think you'll agree it's vital that China is part of that connection. Some observers seem to imply that China's current fascination with English is part of sort of a hegemonic cultural force being placed upon China and other countries, but I think this completely misconstrues what's actually happening. What's actually happening is this: English is not conquering the world. The world is conquering English. And English itself is changing in terms of definition. It's a language that is succeeding where Esperanto and perhaps before that French had failed as world languages. It's as international as mathematics and musical notation, global systems. It's truly the legend on the map of the spoken world. Simply put, English is no longer the language of an empire. It's the language of our world, for better or for worse. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. The problem on languages or on names is not restricted to the mainland. There's a prominent Hong Kong institution here that has two people who are now taking calls from the public, two women, one of whom's name is Windy, W-I-N-D-Y, and the other is Fanny. And it's a universal problem, I think, in terms of trying to improve the guidance to children in terms of name selection. Who would like to go first? Yes, Frederick.
Frederick Bauer from Bloomberg Business Week. Why Hong Kong people seem to have the same love affair? Is it just that love dies after a certain time, or for years people in senior positions have been worrying that one of the threats to Hong Kong's competitiveness is the fact that the level of English taught in the public sector is just not up to scratch. Just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about your business here in Hong Kong.
Sure.
Thanks.
Can you hear me? Oh, okay. Now you can hear me. Thank you. I'm certainly no expert on system in Hong Kong, but Hong Kong is a very different city than most mainland cities. It's a much more international place, and I think that colors the way that students feel about English. That said, we do have a lot of students here in Hong Kong and a blooming business in Hong Kong. And there's somewhat of a similar thing going on in terms of the ability, the perceived ability of our students to grow their wages. But if you look at the demographic, if you segment the market a little bit more closely, you'll see that a big portion of our students as adults are what we would call lifestyle learners. So you see this a lot in Japan. I think 30% of the adult market in Japan are office ladies who have no intention of getting a better job through English. I don't know the exact statistic here in Hong Kong, but it is more a profound fact here that they're learning for international travel, for lifestyle as a hobby. So that is a more prominent piece of the love affair, if you will. There's not quite the same urgency among Hong Kong students to double or triple their salary as there is. And I think it's simply because that's not the dynamic in the workplace. You know, your publication Business Week said that 35% was a worldwide number. That's probably the number in Hong Kong too, whereas if you cross the border in Shenzhen, it's probably twice that. So I think it's much, much more about the actual culture of the city.
Okay. Next. Edith, in the back here, please.
Edith Terry. Although English instruction is embedded in your corporate name, I wonder if looking ahead 20 or 30 years, you might see a world where with those 100 million Chinese tourists going out, you might develop a side business called Chinese First. And what does that imply?
Thank you, Edith. We're actually embroiled in a trademark dispute with a company who has tried to register Chinese First in China. Chinese is the fastest growing language in our portfolio. We actually teach Chinese in centers in Shanghai and Beijing for inbound students. So we do believe that teaching Chinese is going to be an important part of the future. But I don't think it's going to be the world language anytime soon. So I think it's a very different market dynamic. I think there's a lot of curiosity around Chinese. Lots of families in the United States are eager to find Chinese nannies to teach their children Chinese. So there's a lot of hope about that. But I don't think it will become, and the point I was trying to make is that English is more like, you know, musical notation than a spoken language. It's a system for communicating globally. I don't think Chinese is going to usurp that status in my lifetime anyhow.
Over here, please. Can you wait the microphone? I'm sorry, just a moment.
Is the obsessive love affair with American English or British English?
I was waiting for that question.
Glad to oblige.
In China, I am sorry to report that it is a little bit more American English that is desired. But we make an effort to teach all dialects. So we actually, in our online curriculum, for example, we are very careful not to have one dialect. So it's not just American English that we're teaching. If you speak with students, I think, particularly because of the media that they consume, they're a little bit more fascinated with America than with other places. But that's not my choice.
Over here, please.
What are the four companies that have gone bust in the last 3 years on the mainland? You mentioned
the names of them?
Yeah.
Linguaphone was one. You guys might need to help me. Real English in Beijing, I think, was the other. And Cayenne in Shanghai was the third. I mentioned three, I believe, in mainland. There have been a couple here in Hong Kong over the last few years also.
Hi, Bill. Robin Burridge. I was interested in what you were saying about online learning for speaking, and I wondered if you could speak further on that just to explain what you're doing and what your vision for the future is.
Sure. For the last 10 years, we've sort of been convinced that a very important way to allow our students to speak, to gain access to conversation practice, is through using voice over IP. So if you think about Skype, I assume many of us here have used Skype, we have a system similar to that that allows us to pair a teacher with a student in a one-on-one setting to talk about a very specific need, or in a one-on-six setting with a group of students from around the world. We've been doing that for, again, more than a decade. And the great news, the really fun news now, is that technology has gotten so much better in the last just couple of years that that experience is much, much more compelling now than it's ever been before. So if you fast forward another 10 years, to be extreme about it, I think you can start to envision that, you know, in a world where you press a button and a teacher pops up on your TV screen or on your flat screen or as a holograph, that's going to really change the way that we see ourselves in terms of running schools. So a big strategic question we have is, what is the nature of the school of the future? How big is it? It's a very fundamental problem. We spend a lot of money on rent today because we're assuming most of the instruction is done in the center. But we're really thinking that schools will shrink in size, there'll be more experience centers over time, and much more of the instruction will actually be done through video conferencing of various kinds.
Up here, please. Please wait for the microphone and introduce yourselves.
Hi. I was just wondering, when English Towns first started, was it always so large? And as you guys grew, how did you maintain quality control over your teachers?
When we first started, we were very small. I think that's usually how it works. I remember vividly the celebration we had after 1 year when we had 7,000 non-paying members in our database. So that was a big year. That was 1997. The business really, the online instruction business as a paid service really took off when the internet took off. And yes, it was a big challenge to scale up the teacher capacity. But it is much easier to scale up the teacher capacity when teaching online than it is when you have to distribute teachers throughout schools around the world, which we also do very well. Fortunately, EF has know-how in both recruiting and training teachers that we leveraged when we built the online business that made life easy for us. But it is easier to find, because many of our teachers are actually they're teaching from home, they're teaching where they choose to live. Some of them we actually moved to a teaching center in a nice location in the world. But that means you can find better teachers, it's a little bit more of a controllable business, and because there's centralization among the teachers, you can sort of help them, train them, and watch them better. So actually the improvements in quality go faster when you have centralized teaching like that.
We have time for a last question back in the corner.
Hi, Tom Gorman, Fortune China. Just curious about how your current market share is distributed between the main coastal cities and so-called second, third, and fourth tier cities in China.
So that's more a strategy question than a demand question, actually. But we, over the last 5 years, have focused most of our center openings and center growth in the coastal cities, in particular Shanghai, Beijing, Guangzhou, and Shenzhen. That it was a strategic decision. Before that, we had actually focused on second-tier cities. So when we entered China, we started in Shanghai, then in Beijing. Then we immediately went out into the second-tier cities. And we have more presence there than I think anyone else does. But in the last 5 years, we've really focused on getting lots of density in the main cities. However, one reason we did that is that we have a very good, we think, online business that actually can reach into the second-tier cities already. So that decreased some of the urgency in expanding into those cities and gave us a little bit more time to focus on really building a brand presence in the big cities, which I think we've done quite well with.
Thank you very much. And we always like to give our guests something to remember the club by.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all for coming, and we hope you'll sign up for some of our upcoming events as well. Thank you.